Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just when it seemed the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians could not get worse, it has. After declaring Yasser Arafat an enemy, Israel Today sent tanks and troops smashing into the Palestinian leader's Ramallah headquarters. There has been intense fighting with casualties and arrests. For now, it appears a deeply rattled Chairman Arafat is holed up but unharmed. The fighting came one day after an Arab summit in Beirut approved a Saudi peace plan that calls on Arab nations to develop normal relations with Israel in exchange for Israel's withdrawal from territory captured in the 1967 war. Now what? An editorial in today's Wall Street Journal suggests the United States should consider stepping away from, quote, the quicksand of mediating a Palestinian conflict that has defied solution for more than 50 years. In today's Boston Globe, H.D.S. Greenway writes, it's time for foreign troops on the ground, including American troops, to enforce a peace. Is it time for armed international intervention? Should the United States lead the charge, or is the very idea a no-way pipe dream, a ready-made dead end? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a full slate of guests for tonight's discussion, and we begin in Jerusalem live with Harvey Morris. He's a correspondent for the Financial Times in Jerusalem. He joins us there at 3 a.m. Jerusalem time. Good evening, and a special thanks and welcome to you, Harvey Morris, for coming on.
Good evening.
Harvey Morris, catch us up on the latest. We understand there's been fighting all day inside Yasser Arafat's compound in Ramallah. How are the early morning hours finding the status quo?
Well, as of a couple of hours ago, and I have no reason to think the situation has changed in that time, Arafat is on one floor of one building of the compound. The remaining buildings and most of the one he's in having been taken over by Israeli troops. I don't think at the moment there's any fighting. It seems to be a bit of a status quo now, with the Israelis apparently not going to advance any further into his actual private rooms.
Israel has declared Arafat an enemy, in the words of Ariel Sharon. What does that mean? Does that mean a go-ahead for something even more like an all-out war?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, the speculation has been for the last week or two since Sharon pulled the tanks out of Ramallah last time that there was going to be a second round of this. And the fact that suicide bombings have carried on obviously provided the context for him to do that. What he means quite by Arafat being an enemy, I'm not quite sure. I mean, a couple of months back, he described Arafat as irrelevant. Mm-hmm. But Arafat's remained pretty relevant to the process. And Colin Powell said today even that he was just as relevant as ever. Also, Sharon said that the idea was to isolate Arafat. That was another phrase that he didn't really expand on either. So it's not always quite clear from Sharon's sometimes rather cryptic statements what the actual strategy is.
Well, at the moment, Yasser Arafat, we're told, is holed up in one windowless room on the first or second floor of the headquarters there. Isolation certainly seems to have been achieved.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think it may be isolation in the sense that they want to cut him off from any outside contact. I mean, at the moment, he spent the day talking to foreign leaders, to Colin Powell, to Anthony Zinni, the mediator who's over here from the States. He talked to CNN. So he was still pretty much in the picture.
That surprised me to some extent, Harvey Morris, that the Israelis allowed that kind of communication to continue. He was even live, I guess, on Al Jazeera, the Arab satellite television channel, saying, they want me under arrest or in exile or dead, but I'm telling them I prefer to be martyred. May God make us martyrs. Can't the Israelis shut this down somehow?
Well, there are some reports tonight that the electricity has been cut off and that the Palestinians still inside with Arafat have just got mobile phones at the moment. There were also some incidents in Ramallah today where the Israelis went in and closed down some offices of news agencies or made them evacuate. Now, whether that's a crackdown on the media to prevent any contact, or whether that was a military move to take over a particular building, is not quite clear.
Let's say that this particular chapter concludes with Israeli soldiers sitting right outside Yasser Arafat's door, which effectively they seem nearly to be at this point.
Well, inside the door, actually.
Well, I mean, even the door of his inside room. What is the advantage? What is the effect?
Well, it's very hard to say. As I say, Colin Powell made it, although he was not terribly sympathetic to the Palestinians in his remarks today, he did caution the Israelis that they better think carefully about what they're doing. But he did stress that as far as Washington is concerned, Arafat is still a player and still a vital part of the peace process. So it's difficult to see how he can play that role if he's under such tight control. He's already been under siege in the compound for getting on for 4 months now.
Mm-hmm. The Arab summit in Beirut has, of course, now disbanded. The Saudi peace plan or initiative was approved, and there was some degree of excitement around that in some quarters for the apparent readiness to recognize Israel in return for withdrawal from West Bank and Gaza. Why is Israel so cold toward this plan, Harvey Morris?
They're not actually cold towards it. I mean, in a strange way, they've welcomed the initiative, if not the substance of it. And I think if one can see beyond the terrible escalation that we're seeing at the moment, the Arab endorsement of that plan may well become important in the future, because when, as everybody knows, they eventually have to get down to negotiating this situation, at least the Arabs will be able to say that a priori they have put forward this initiative. Now, the Palestinians would say at the moment that what's happening in Ramallah is an Israeli response to the initiative. And they say that is because Ariel Sharon in particular and the right-wing members of his government have no intention of reaching a peace settlement on that basis. And the basis is total withdrawal from occupied territory in return for normal relations with the Arab world. Now, Ariel Sharon said very clearly this week that he could not possibly accept such a deal.
He said return to the 67 borders will destroy Israel.
He said it would destroy Israel because he has always held that Israel must hold the Jordan Valley as its international border, that it must retain many of the settlements in the West Bank, certainly, and possibly in the Gaza Strip, and that a future Palestinian state must be demilitarized. Now, that's his starting position. The Saudi initiative is the Arab starting position. Eventually, God knows when, they're going to come to a conclusion, which probably is somewhere in between.
Harvey Morris, there are wildly varying views in the United States of what the American position ought to be at this point. The Wall Street Journal is editorializing in favor of a hands-off policy, let the Israelis go after the terrorists in their midst. Others, Tom Friedman and other columnists, are saying it is time not only for intervention, but for armed intervention by American troops to separate these effectively combatants and make a peace possible that they cannot make possible themselves. Can you imagine that latter ever taking hold in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? That's what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah. Well, may I deal just very briefly with the former. I think it's difficult for the United States when it's taking such a proactive role in the rest of the world, in its war on terrorism, to sort of isolate the Middle East and say, well, we're not going to get involved in that particular one. After all, Iraq is practically next door and clearly is a high priority for Washington. On the second point, the problem with intervention is that although the Palestinians have constantly urged the presence of international observers here to show, as they contend, that they are the victims rather than the perpetrators of violence, Israel has always rejected that. And nobody has ever pushed them very hard to reverse that opinion. There was talk when Anthony Zinni came back a couple of weeks ago that he might even bring observers with him. Mm-hmm. I think at some stage an observer force of sorts, whatever it's called, may be required, but I cannot contemplate a situation in which Israel would accept armed personnel here. And I'm not quite sure what they would do, actually. Mm. It's difficult to conceive.
Harvey Morris, stand by. We're going to expand our circle here. Before we do, just to get it out there, we have Tom Friedman saying there is no way that America will be able to sustain a successful Middle East policy, whether it wants to invade Iraq or to do anything else in the region, unless the U.S. is prepared to station American troops on the ground indefinitely around both Afghanistan and Israel. This last week in the New York Times and raised again today in the Boston Globe. And the question is it time for armed intervention to staunch a war that the Palestinians and Israelis do not appear capable of solving themselves? We're joined now from Washington by Mohammed Abu Nimer. He's professor at the School of International Service at American University. He's a specialist in peace, conflict, and negotiation. Good evening and welcome, Mohammed Abu Nimer. Hello, Mohammed Abu Nimer, are you there? Hello, Mohammed Abu Nimer, are you there?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear now. Thanks for joining us this evening.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me.
You have no doubt followed, along with millions of others around the world, the events in Israel and the West Bank today. What's your interpretation of what's going on right now on the ground in Ramallah at the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority where Yasser Arafat is holed up?
Well, I think that what's happening all day, and I've been watching both the Arabic media and the American-based media, it's a drama that's unfolding in front of our eyes, and it really reflects the helplessness and also the hopelessness of the Palestinian, both civilian people as well as leadership. All day, Arafat is crying for help from the Arab world, from the Muslim world, from the European, from the American, and the help did not really come to him, and the Israeli tanks are on the doors of his room, as mentioned by Harvey in Jerusalem.
Mohammed Abu Nimer, where do you think this conflict is headed next after such a dramatic new step?
I think the region in general is on the brink of a big you know, tragedy and explosion. Egypt today called the Israeli ambassador. There are some movement in the Egyptian streets for protest. And I don't think the Arab countries can sustain pressure from their constituency or from the people in the street. My fear, and I share that with many Palestinians, that Sharon is using this offensive as a stepping stone towards something more dangerous that will produce some more refugees and really will take the chance of completely destroying the Palestinian leadership. Before, I mean, just let me say that what Hamas have done last week and the killing of the civilian, of Israeli civilian inside Israel is absolutely not justified. Killing of any civilian in both sides is not justified. And what we are seeing now is really the culmination of a long policy of a year or so, in which the U.S. hands-off policy gave practically a green light for Sharon to do his job as he done in Lebanon.
Mohammed Abu Nimer, can you see a role for international troops, U.S. troops, in separating these two sides and creating a zone of security that would allow this conflict to cool and perhaps a peace to grow?
As it is now, with the leadership of Arafat and the leadership of Sharon, and the fact that the U.S. is the only superpower that can dictate such terms, I don't see any way out except having international troops, whether they are combined by American troops or European or international. It doesn't really matter. What we need a force on the ground that will be capable of stopping the Israeli invasion of the Palestinian city and also separating the forces of the Palestinians and the Israeli. Although, I mean, let's be clear, I think it's very important to indicate what we're dealing with, a state with nuclear power ability attacking a group of militia who are hundreds of them in the streets. That's what we're dealing with.
So. We understand, but even they're increasingly sophisticated. Even Israeli tanks are coming down now. This conflict is evolving. Should international troops, should United States troops be involved in helping bring peace to the Israelis and Palestinians? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The question tonight is, should international troops be put on the ground to separate Israelis and Palestinians? Must this fire burn itself out? Or should the West, the United States, step in? Should the United States, the United Nations, send troops in to keep these warring parties apart? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Let's listen to what we heard today from Secretary of State Colin Powell.
The President and I are gravely concerned at the situation today in Ramallah. We deplore the killing and wounding of innocent Palestinians there, while we understand the Israeli government need to respond to these acts of terror and the right of the Israeli government to decide what actions serve the interest of the Israeli people. We call on Prime Minister Sharon and his government to carefully consider the consequences of those actions. Chairman Arafat is the leader of the Palestinian people, and his leadership is now even more central to trying to find a way out of this tragic situation.
That was Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking out today about the attack by Israel on Yasser Arafat's headquarters. Tensions are rising to unbelievable levels, and heretofore, unimagined kinds of solutions are being floated. Just last week, Thomas Friedman, columnist for The New York Times, wrote, the U.S. can no longer afford just to let them go on killing each other. It will undermine America's whole position in the Middle East. It will spin off more and more suicide craziness that will land at our door. And it will make it impossible for the United States to take on Saddam, that is, Saddam Hussein. We're talking tonight with Harvey Morris, Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times, and Mohammed Abu-Nimer, professor at the School of International Service at American University. Mohammed Abu-Nimer, Tom Friedman suggests an international intervention like this. He says the only solution is that Israel gradually withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, to be replaced by a joint American-Palestinian security force. Palestinians would be responsible for internal security, and the joint U.S.-Palestinian security force would control all borders and entryways. Can you imagine this actually working, Mohammed Abu-Nimer?
I mean, I can imagine, you know, any of these formulas work, provided that there is a basic security protection for the Palestinian population, as well as basic security protection for the Israeli civilian who are subject to this explosion. I can imagine that. That's not. I think that after Oslo, there was an arrangement that have worked for a couple of years, at least immediately after Oslo, where there was Palestinian and Israeli joint security patrol, mm-hmm. and the PLO or the PA, the Palestinian Authority, mm-hmm. controlled a certain percentage of the territory, and they actually managed that area as they were expected.
Harvey Morris, I want to turn to you. This is a columnist writing from New York. You're on the ground every day. You're in Jerusalem, 9 miles from Ramallah. Can you practically imagine this kind of intervention working?
You know, the British were here for 31 years until mm-hmm. the foundation of the State of Israel, mm-hmm. and they came with the intention of overseeing the establishment of a Jewish homeland and protecting the rights of the Arabs, and they ended up getting bombed out by both sides. Mm-hmm. And I fear that any international force in this situation would find itself at the end of the barrel of guns from both sides, frankly. The trouble is there isn't a front line. If you're dealing with suicide bombers, you know, how does any force keep them out if their intention is to perpetrate such attacks? The other problem is, what border is this joint force going to patrol? Because the Palestinians want to know what is the final settlement. They don't want to ensure security in an area which they don't feel is the full extent of their future state, when Israel continues to build settlements and expand its hold on other areas which are still occupied. Mm-hmm. So the question remains, what's the final map? And that will one day have to be determined. And I think having any sort of force may cool the violence for the time being, but it doesn't present a final solution.
Harvey Morris, Mohammed Amin-Eber, please stand by. We're joined in the studio now by Gidi Greenstein. He's former secretary of the Israeli delegation to the permanent status negotiation with Palestinians. He's now a fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening and welcome, Gidi Greenstein.
Thank you very much for having me here. Thank
you for coming in. Gidi, we're using Todd Friedman's column as a touchstone tonight just to spark this conversation because the conflict has stepped up to a new level. Everybody can see it. The stakes are enormous. Friedman writes, Israel, there's a central dilemma, he says. Israel cannot stay in the occupied territories and remain a Jewish democracy. But the Palestinians cannot yet be trusted to control these areas on their own if Israel withdraws. His solution? U.S. forces on the ground. You know this territory so well. You've been in the Israeli army. You've studied these. The negotiations have been part of them for years. Can you imagine this emerging as a real course of action?
I can imagine this emerging as a real course of action only in the context of a political process. I think the basic premise of this conflict today is that there is no military solution to the conflict. And that applies to any kind of on-the-ground involvement of any of the parties. So in the context of a political move forward, I can see U.S.-led forces being introduced into the area in order to maintain peace and stability and good neighborly relations. And that was actually one of the ideas that were discussed during the negotiations between 1999 and 2001. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling it was accepted by both sides at that time.
That even U.S. forces?
We were using the term U.S.-led forces, mm-hmm. meaning it would be forces of an international character, but led by the United States, introduced for the purpose of implementing the agreement and helping both sides maintain an area of stability and security.
But Gidi Greenstein, you've seen, as we all have, exactly what's going on there today. A political solution, even a political conversation, seems miles and miles away from what's happened today at the Palestinian Authority headquarters in Ramallah. And it's just out of the frustration about exactly that situation that people are saying, we can't wait at this point. We have to impose something before these people turn this into an even larger conflict that kills more of them and more of others as well.
The challenge on the Palestinian side is a challenge of state building. And Israel has been putting tremendous effort in trying to contain terrorism and guerrilla warfare unsuccessfully. I find it hard to see or hard to envision an international force that does more successfully than what Israel does without the political commitment of the Palestinian leadership for efforts that fall within the framework of state building, meaning consolidation of all armed forces under the control of the central government. Once this happens, a lot of things can come out of this historic shift, I think, on the Palestinian side. Similar shifts need to happen on the Israeli side as well.
Harvey Morris, I know we're keeping you up in the middle of the night. I want to get one last remark from you. Sure. Can you see any sprouts, any hope for a political conversation emerging, or are we headed simply into a bloody conflict here, a bloody war?
Well, I hope not. The nature of this conflict has tended to be that there's been a mighty escalation, which then has suddenly been stopped in its tracks, invariably by U.S. and other international pressure, only, I fear, to start again sometimes later and usually to a greater extent. So there is a sort of cycle which has gaps in between. Mm-hmm. One can only hope there'll be another gap fairly soon and that this time will be an opportunity for people to say we really have to treat the core issues before this thing gets out of control.
We'll pray for that gap, and we thank you very much, Harvey Morris, for coming on at this time of night there. Thank you so much. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times. And the question is, can the world afford to let these antagonists fight to the death, or is a terrible knockdown drag out the only way to ultimate peace? Must it be a peace of blood and exhaustion? Should the U.S. step in? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Al is on the line. Welcome, Al. You're on the air.
Thank you. My opinion on this matter is that U.S. troops should definitely not get involved in this conflict because no matter how even-handed we are, mm-hmm. We'll be seen as friends of Israel. and we will definitely be target of extremist suicide bombers of Hamas, which is really a secondary government in the Palestinian-controlled areas.
Mm-hmm.
Short of American airlifting all the Jews out of there and away, including Israel proper itself, we're going to be attacked, and we're going to lose a lot of men and women over there, and there's no recourse. And the other thing I want to say
yes.
is that the Palestinian areas, there's a civil war going to happen if they do get their freedom, which is going to be between Hamas and the secular Palestinian Authority, and Hamas may win, and you'll have an extremist Palestinian-controlled group in there that will be completely confrontational, that will be unable to be dealt with no matter what. So it's a real mess over there, and we can't get our troops involved. We will come home with a lot of body bags.
So to you, Al, this is a picture, this is a scene that you do not want to put young American men and women into.
Well, you look at Beirut, 1983, and the point that I want to make is there's a conference in Beirut. This happened, the massacre there,
mm-hmm.
During this conference, and there was no expressions of sympathy or contrition. There was nothing said whatsoever.
Just dead American troops. Al, thanks very much for your call. Mohammed Abunimer, please respond. You hear the concern here. On the one hand, this conflict can turn into something that involves much of the world in a very ugly way. On the other, putting American troops in there may simply expose them to great harm without ultimately solving the problem.
Well, I understand and I agree to those two concerns. And I would like to pick up on what Mr. Grissin have suggested, which is the political context. Any throwing of troops in this context would be dangerous, obviously. However, there need to be a link with a possible political settlement and a political process that will give both Palestinians and Israelis, but particularly Palestinians, a hope that this intervention, this protection force that will be on the ground, is actually leading them toward something tangible and something more than what Sharon is willing to offer.
But do you think that there's a political solution or path? Is there one that exists which would satisfy the most militant elements on both sides that would restrain them, that would lead them not even to be interested in terrorist attacks on American troops?
Yes. I mean, yesterday, Hamas spokesman in Beirut and also in Syria, both of them said that if Israel accepts the Saudi plan, they are willing to accept and negotiate that plan, and that clear indication that they are willing to stop their activity. In addition, in the past, Hamas have suspended its activity inside Israel, giving Arafat and giving the Israeli negotiator to reach some form of settlement. Unfortunately, I think we are in this situation because the political settlement was not implemented on the ground to give Arafat and his leadership any way to convince the Palestinian people that negotiating with the Israeli is worth and giving them any hope. So where would you go if the negotiations are not helping you, your life is in danger, you cannot move from one village to the other, the inflation and the economic situation is horrible? Where would you turn if you were 16 or 17 years old, young boy or young girl, who's totally desperate to get rid of the humiliating reality of the occupation?
Well, we see where young people there are turning, and it's grim, Giddy Greenstein, but what about this central issue? Is there a political path, in your view, that would be compelling enough to all parties that it could suck the violence out of this, that it would satisfy, even pacify, the hardcore militants, you could say on both sides, but certainly in this case we need to know about the Palestinians?
I think the driving tension on both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side at the top leadership, Sharon and Arafat, is history versus politics. For Sharon, it's to disengage himself from the legacy of the right wing in Israel, and for Arafat, it is to disengage himself from the legacy of a leader of national liberation movement and turn into a head of state. Once those two things happen, and they need to happen in a synchronized manner, meaning at the same time, then we have a prospect for a political process. Now, the end game was basically captured by the ideas presented by President Clinton on December 23rd, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the process should go. This was the outcome of an extensive set of negotiations between Israeli and Palestinian delegations. It addresses all the issues on the table. And that should be the terms of reference for returning to the negotiations and moving forward. And one last comment concerning what my the previous speaker said.
Mohammed Abu Nimer.
A lot of peoples have engaged in struggle for national liberation. Not all of them have engaged in the kind of activities that we see by Hamas and Jihad. The option of a Palestinian 16 or 17 year old goes far beyond exploding oneself in the centers of Israeli and Jewish settlements. We've seen India. We've seen other places in the world in which other manners of struggle against the concept of occupation we're engaged in.
Mm-hmm. You know, I can I respond, Tom?
Mohammed, please.
With all due respect to my Israeli colleague here, Gristin, it's very easy for you and me in the U.S. to dictate to the Palestinian what to do. I wasn't implying that suicide bombing is justified. I was just describing to you and to the other listeners that under such reality that the Palestinian experience in the occupation, it is very hard to expect the Palestinian to offer gifts and roses to the Israeli soldiers.
And we hear you, but we can also wish for a different approach. I want to go to the lines. Mildred is on the line. Welcome, Mildred. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was press officer when Israel was created in 47 General Assembly.
Press officer for the United Nations?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I was in charge of the Arab group, which was under Sir Mohammed Zabrullah Khan. And the Arab plan was very good, except for one very bad drawback. And that was that the Israeli immigrants would not be able to vote for 20 years. And naturally, that killed it.
Mildred, would you vote for sending U.S. troops in to pull
Absolutely
these two sides apart?
Not.
Why not? Why not?
Well, we're not unbiased. We're too involved with Israel. If anybody went in, it would have to be the United Nations. And I don't think they'll go in.
So is this fire just going to burn itself out? Isn't that a bloody price to pay, Mildred?
I don't think that the U.S. would make it less bloody. I think they'd make it more bloody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm absolutely against the U.S. going in. And I do wish that somebody would suddenly realize that the main thing is it's a real estate problem. When Israel was created, there were a certain number of Israelis and a certain number of Palestinians. And what was a couple in 47 is now a family of 42 or 44.
Mm-hmm. Mildred, our time is almost up before the break. When you were there in 1947, did you ever imagine the conflict would go on this long?
I hope not. I don't think so.
Yeah, well, and here we are 50-plus years later, and it still goes. Mildred, thank you very much for your call. We're talking tonight on a dark night in Israel and the West Bank about ways out of this dilemma. Is it possible, we're just floating this tonight, that intervention by armed forces of outside countries, the UN, the United States, may be necessary to pull these parties apart? Should the U.S., the UN, send troops in to keep Israelis and Palestinians apart? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Israel, the Palestinians, and maybe, just maybe, the need for international armed intervention, U.S. intervention, to pull these warring nearly parties now apart. We're joined tonight by Gidi Greenstein. He's former secretary of the Israeli delegation to the permanent status negotiations with the Palestinians. He's now a fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. By Mohammed Abu Nimer. He's a professor at the School of International Service at American University. And right now by Dennis Sullivan. He's chair of the Political Science Department at Northeastern University. Good evening and welcome, Dennis Sullivan.
Good evening.
We've been quoting Tom Friedman a lot tonight, but he's kind of a touchstone for us this evening. He says, Israelis and Palestinians do not have the resources or mutual trust ever to find their way out of this problem alone. He says, and I quote, Israel can kill Palestinians till the cows come home, unquote, and it won't solve this problem. Dennis Sullivan, is it time to think about U.S. armed intervention.
Absolutely. This is the time, and as Giddy mentioned earlier, it would have to be coupled with a political intervention, a very high level and very forthright leadership role, both politically and also on the issue of international observers, international monitors. We could debate whether this is armed forces or protection forces or whatever, but just the notion we should keep it alive, this idea that Palestinians need protection from Israelis, as do Israelis need protection from Palestinians, and we are the only body to lead an international force to do that.
Palestinians have wanted outside intervention for a long time. Israel has always firmly opposed it. Can you imagine Israel being open to it now?
No. That's the unfortunate thing. Under this Israeli leadership, that is, Ariel Sharon's government really is the primary obstacle. Had we had a different prime minister, one, we probably wouldn't be in this situation we're in. We probably wouldn't have to have this discussion. But given the reality we're at, when we get to the next Israeli prime minister, whenever that is, that person might have a little choice but to accept U.S. intervention.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Sullivan, I want to thank you so much for joining us just for these couple minutes tonight. Sure. Thanks for being with us. Sure. Dennis Sullivan is chair of the Political Science Department at Northeastern University. The question for callers: must this fire burn itself out, or should the West, the United States, step in? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Muhammad is on the line. Muhammad, welcome. You're on the
yes.
air.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to echo what Mildred said before and to say something very I'm very skeptical, because to actually put U.S. forces inside, you would have to first okay the Israelis to do it,
mm-hmm.
because obviously they're the major power involved.
Mm-hmm.
And considering the U.S. tilt towards Israel so far, all the vetoed United Sanction resolutions, I would be very skeptical about U.S. forces there. United Nations forces, absolutely. But I doubt Israel would allow that. So I think U.S. forces is probably just going to sanction the occupation further.
Mm-hmm. Stay out. Mohammed, thank you for your call. Alex is on the line. Welcome, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I don't think we should send any American troops to the area, because even if they may provide some protection for the Palestinians when Israelis want to retaliate for the murder like the Palestinians did
mm-hmm.
during the Passover,
yes.
How are they going to provide the Israelis from the suicide bombers? I think it's going to be absolutely possible. I think we should let Israel take the matter into their own hands and defend the state like the America does, and just wipe out the terrorist infrastructure.
Alex, thank you for your call and for your comment. Charles is on the line. Welcome, Charles. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. Good evening.
I was just noticing, I was just thinking about what that lady said about how it seems to be one-sided. It seems to me that there's a real simple way to at least start something going, and that would be to put a few sanctions on Israel and stop a lot of the funding that's going on, and that would at least stop them and get them to think, and maybe it would at least level out the playing field a little bit.
But Israel is a strong military power, a nuclear military power. Would that really be in the interests of the region and the U.S.?
Well, the thing of it is, we've backed them for so long, it's, you know, we're sort of like, not much we can, I mean, not much that anybody, that's why nobody likes us anymore, because of the same reason. If we would just finally stand up and say, fine, we're getting out of it totally, and then you would probably have some kind of a basis, so that now the Palestinians would be able to, get back on level playing ground.
You want everybody to feel the heat, I guess, Charles, and thank you for your call. But on the other hand, it seems like everybody is feeling heat one way or another. Marcia is on the line. Welcome, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Pleasure.
I just wanted to say that I agree with the caller before. We need to stop funding both sides, because they're both committing heinous acts. Both sides are committing heinous acts, and they've gotten themselves into this situation. And to put us in the middle of it, every terrorist suicide bomber that could find their way to Palestine, or whatever you call it, Israel, Palestine, whatever, mm-hmm. would show up there ready to bomb us and hurt us. And
mm-hmm.
that makes no sense to me whatsoever. Why would we insert ourselves into the middle of something like that?
I guess, Marcia, I just want to get your response to this. The argument being made is that if this fire spreads over the whole region, we could end up with a giant conflict, and terrorists in the United States spun out of this conflict.
Exactly. That's the very reason why we cannot because the woman was right. She was right on target.
Mildred?
If people will see us as siding with the Israelis, mm-hmm. and we're already tied to them enough, this will just make that worse, and then they'll turn on us. I think the Israelis need to look, really, we all need to take a look. What's going to go on a couple generations from now? They assume that America, you know, every great power comes to an end. What are they going to do without us? We can't get tied anymore into this situation. It's too dangerous. And I've never protested anything in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one thing I would protest, is to send our men in there, our men and women, in the middle of that craziness. They don't even respect their own lives. Mm. Neither side doesn't respect life.
Marcia, we hear your passion. Our time is winding down, but we thank you for your comments and your call. Mohammed Amin-Emer, I guess overall we're hearing from callers opposition to this, because it just doesn't look like it will make a difference. It looks like the United States will be pulled into a cauldron that it itself will be chewed up by.
See, I mean, I understand that. Sending American troops only right now at these under circumstances will not resolve and will create probably more problem. I think it needs to be either U.S.-led or mainly United Nations, but the U.S. has a major role to play in this, and hear me a little bit on this. One thing, the U.S. in 1990 placed pressure on Israeli government, on Shamir government, to join for the first time in their history the talks in Madrid, Spain, by using the leverage of the loan guarantee, the $10 billion. The U.S. has a special relation with Israel. That relation can be used.
You want to see them use it, Mohammed Amin-Emer? I want to get one last comment from Gidi Greenstein. Where are the moderates here? Is there any way they can emerge from this violence?
I think that one of the driving dynamics of the region is the swing between the moderates and the radicals. And by moderates, I mean Israelis, Palestinians, Jordanians, Egyptians, all over the Middle East. And there is basically a coalition of moderates in the Middle East. And that coalition has suffered serious setbacks, but I hope that it will bounce back. The moment we'll be able to pin down a ceasefire, and we were not that far a week ago. And in the context of a decisive U.S. Involvement, which offers a vision that frames the issues properly, that crafts the interventions and makes them properly, and these are very serious challenges, and that goes beyond military involvement on the ground, we can have a swing of the pendulum towards a much more peaceful solution.
Just 10 seconds. Would outside armed intervention help make room for moderates? Yes or no?
Only in the context of the political vision.
Mm-hmm. Gidi Greenstein, senior fellow at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thanks so much for being with us tonight. And Mohammed Amin-Emer, professor at the School of International Service at American University, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
You can view photos of the fighting today in Ramallah. Log on to our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a living version of Da Vinci's Last Supper in Brainerd, Minnesota. Wednesday, parishioners of the Church of the Nazarene in Brainerd, Minnesota, reenacted the scene from Leonardo da Vinci's painting The Last Supper in what has become an annual Easter week tradition there. In this radio diary, three men who posed as Matthew, Simon the Zealot, and Judas share their thoughts from the experience of standing in as apostles this Holy Week.
I'm David E. Deeds. I'm a retired teacher here in Brainerd. I taught here for 33 years. And I play the part of Matthew in the Living Last Supper. The lights go out, and each disciple is called onto the stage, and then the spotlights come on, the curtain opens, and you have a picture of the Living Last Supper in 3D. When the curtain opens, there's usually kind of you hear the people drawing their breath, and maybe a couple oohs or an ah. They're just looking. Many of them look to see if anybody's moving. The poses are held for about two and a half minutes. When I'm sitting at the table and the curtain is drawn, my whole thought at that moment is to be still, not have to clear my throat or sneeze or cough. I play the part of Matthew, and if you look at the picture, I'm down at the on the painting, the right end of the table, and I have my arms up in the air, and I'm looking the other direction, and trying to hold them still is a small task. Afterwards, when we're able to move again, we always mingle with the audience. It's quite exciting to hear, you know, their feelings, their thoughts. I know some of the people that have been drawn closer to the Lord through this experience. It's just a wonderful experience for us.
My name is Gordon Hardy, and I play Simon the Zealot. I'm the man, as you're looking at the table, I'm on your right-hand end, with a bewildered look and my hands uplifted, saying, "Surely not I, Lord." In the evening, when we do the Living Last Supper, the narrator calls each of us by name, and then we, one by one, step out from behind the curtain. And as he reads, he tells who we were before Christ called us, what kind of lifestyle. And my lifestyle, as you may know, Simon the Zealot was of the political persuasion that if he didn't like what the publicans were doing, he carried a dagger. And so he was kind of a scoundrel. A few of the people that Christ called were scoundrels. And one of my greatest thrills in doing this was one year we had a lady here that had never been to it before. And she was not a Christian lady, just happened to hear about it and came. And she was so touched by the story of what Christ did, you know, in the sacrifice and everything, that she, from this, became a Christian. So we were very happy to have been a part in her life that introduced her to Christ. When we do this, it's a very serious moment. We realize that we are playing the characters of Christ's disciples, which, you know, these are honored people to us that we've studied over the years. And to have a part in it, we realize that many people in the audience are really examining their own life. And so it's really a very important thing. It's a thrill when we talk to people afterwards and they tell us how this performance has moved them. We're just being obedient, you know, to do our little part.
My name is Tony Gage. I work for the Highway Department, Minnesota Department of Transportation, hauling snow and fixing highways and things like that. And I play Judas. Pastor kind of looks for different, I don't know, bone structures, goes with the picture of Da Vinci's, and just kind of looks for physical characteristics and tries to match each person up with the painting. In my case, I've been blessed with no hair, so they need to paint my hair on, which gets a lot of comments, but it's worth it in the long run. The thing that I think mostly, especially the first year I went through it, I read quite a bit on the character of Judas, what his part was in the Bible and things, and it kind of, I would imagine it's a little bit like an actor, you know, trying to get into the mind of the character. In the picture, he holds the pose of, like, complete awe of, like, how does Jesus know that I've already done this? And so I hold the pose of complete surprise, you know, and what's going to happen next. And I kind of look in my own life sometimes of the things that I've done, and we all have a little bit of Judas in us. And so in my own life, I look at that as, you know, there's things that I'm not real proud of, but yet that I hold on to the fact that I know that my God will forgive me.
That was David Eads, Gordon Hardy, and Tony Gage talking about their roles in Brainerd, Minnesota's Living Last Supper as Matthew, Simon the Zealot, and Judas. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.